Hello and welcome to Angels Costumes Behind the Scenes. I'm Jeremy Angel.
I'm Richard Green.
And I'm Jonathan Lippman.
Today's podcast is a conversation I had with Kenny Crouch. Kenny goes back a long, long way. He started with Berman's The Costume House in 1969. And over the course of his career, he has worked on a huge number of costume productions, working with the best costume designers. His work's taken him all over the world, and he is a very experienced wardrobe supervisor, costume supervisor, wardrobe master.
I hope it's come across with some of the interviews we've done with other supervisors that just how important that role is and how challenging it is, and it's changed so much over the years. I'm sure you've got the idea from our other interviews, but organizing the entire costume department for big shoots and things like that, for big scenes, that is no easy feat. And it's something that all these people have to deal with while a set is going on and filming is going on. They've got to be planning the next day as well as the big crowd day that's going on then. It's not an easy job to do.
No, and Kenny makes mention sort of a budget of £1 million. You know, we're not talking about chicken feed here by any stretch of the imagination.
The interesting aspect of what you got out of Kenny, Richard, was that he loves his job. And he thrives on being completely immersed in the world. And what I found most impressive was how much he gets himself involved in every department, because in order for him to do the job that he does to the best of his ability, he has to have a complete understanding of every aspect of production design, the scheduling, the other departments' logistics. And I think that that's a situation that you can only fully grasp when you have had the years of experience that he has.
Yeah.
And the other interesting connection that I made was that, in fact, the only jobs that I've ever gone out to do as a dailies to get experience with how it all works. And it's only happened 3 times, actually. And all 3 of those jobs were jobs that Kenny was the costume supervisor on.
Oh.
And it was only that connection that was made after I'd heard what you two were discussing.
Do you think that's because when Kenny works on a show, it's normally large crowd numbers, so therefore they need additional help. Therefore, there's a slot for you available for you to go along and do.
Yeah, and over the years, you know, having known him now for so many years, if I was costuming a job that he was supervising on, you know, give it a Saturday or a Sunday, he'd say, well, come out, John, because we've got a big crowd that day and you can join in, or you can just see what it's all about.
Yeah,
it was that inclusiveness and generosity that actually made me realize that supervision is not a job that I could ever have undertaken. I would never have managed to have achieved what he has subsequently achieved.
Now, that's a very interesting point as well, because traditionally, back in those days, people working in costume houses were fairly low paid, whereas people who went out into the big wide world, there were some very large money to be made. You know, it was possible to make quite a lot of money on these productions. And one of the reasons why you and I and others would go out on Saturdays and Sundays and bank holidays and things was they were sort of inviting us as a way of supplementing, if you like, our kind of income. You know, it was quite good. On 1984, I remember we did a night shoot at Alexandra Palace, you know, and it was silly money for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guys were coming around with cash. Not illegally, it was all accounted for, but it was actually a cash payment rather than a bank transfer at that point.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of money. And it actually, in a way, let you carry on working in a costume house because you could supplement your salary with the costume house's knowledge. We weren't working illegally. But that seems to have changed, and that's the point that Kenny makes. Whether that's because the numbers of people employed on these things have changed. So, and Tim's theory that there is only a certain amount of cake in the, you know, the costume business, and it depends how that's sliced up, which I think is and something we should maybe develop at some point, this theory that there is only an amount of money and it depends where it goes and which way it's spent.
We all like cake.
We all like cake, yes. Yeah. This is getting like one of those cricket commentators where we get, I'd like to thank Mrs. Robinson for the delicious fruitcake.
The other thing which I think is interesting to point out as well is people have noticed now more and more in cinema over the last 10 years, after we watch a film, how long the credits actually are.
Yeah.
And it gives you an idea, not just how big the crew is, but if you actually break that down and just look at the costume department with that, you can be 10, 20 seconds in the credit just to have all the makers, all the dyers, all the breaking down, all the standbys, everything like that. And that whole department, it's the designer and supervisor have to pick it and control it and run it and pay for them and control their budget. And it's an amazing team. And it seems to have been a more of a tradition now. People do stay to the end to watch it because that is, it sounds a weird thing, but it's a mini appreciation. At least I used to feel that on films when I'd worked on them, when you were sitting there watching the credits come and people were staying to watch it, because that's the recognition you get, because it's the only time outside of the designers and the top line people that your name would come up, because it comes up at the beginning for all of the heads of department, but everyone else at the end.
Previously, and I'm not quite sure what that date is, but prior to the situation that we're in now, where credits roll for
ever,
you know, up to 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
We have to wait until the Queen's play at the end.
We've got your opening titles with your heads of departments, which would have included the costume supervisor,
yep,
as well as the designer. Mm. But there was absolutely no way that you would have had the lists and lists of operators and technicians and ancillary supports as the closing credits. The film would have finished with the end, and that would have been it. There must have been some shift, whether it was an American Union situation or something that's affected the fact that now you have to have, I don't know if it's by law, but it's certainly contractual, this endless roll of credits. And I think that as fascinating as it might be, I actually think that it's revealing too much about the product.
Huh.
I think it takes away from the mystique, mystery, and the magic, because I think it's explaining everything.
I've never thought of it that way. That's actually a really interesting way of looking at it. It's, yeah, you go to the cinema to suspend disbelief and to lose yourself in something, and then the credits, with what you're saying, the credits are sort of a nod to, well, actually, that's great, but this is really, really what happened, or these are the people who made that happen. Yeah. So break the illusion.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like going for a really great meal in a restaurant and then at the end of it having all the sort of, you know, the kitchen staff come out and
yeah,
sort of, you know, yeah, come and take a bow. And actually you're right, Jonathan. Of course it's important that everybody's work is recognized. I guess that's what IMDb's for. But you want to walk away with your impression of the film fresh and right there in your mind, and that 5 minutes or however long it is where you sit there, and we do sit there because it is professional courtesy and etiquette not to get up unless you've got the last bus, of course, but to you sit there for 5 minutes and the film is beginning to kind of fade in your mind, because you know you're waiting to see who the wardrobe staff are, I suppose. So yeah, it's an interesting point.
I suppose at least Marvel started the I might be very wrong by saying it was Marvel who started this, but running, well, actually no, I think Pixar did it as well, is they started rolling extra clips in the credits to make sure people stayed and watched. And
yes, and actually you're right, because sometimes, you know, I can't remember what it was, but there's a whole ending, isn't there? You know, you get up and everybody rushes out, and actually there's another scene.
Definitely.
Well, I find that very, very divisive, and I don't like it, because it's very clearly placed so that it forces you to sit there through those credits.
Mm.
I don't have any objection with people being acknowledged and recognised for the work that they do, but they're doing a job and they're being paid for it, and for the most part, they're being paid very well. And I then don't understand, because you don't get it in a theatre, you don't get it in an opera, you don't get it in a concert hall, in any other public performing environment, you're not subjected to sit there for that amount of time to pay respect or to pay your respect to the technical.
No, you're right again, because again, if all the front of house staff at the theatre sort of came along and at the end and sort of, you know, lined up and so you could shake their hands as you left, again, extraordinarily divisive.
We hope you've been enjoying these interviews. We've certainly been enjoying your feedback. If you have any questions, requests or messages, please just email us on podcast@angels.co.uk, or you can visit our website, www.angelsbehindtheseams.com. Or you can find us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, we are /costume podcast. And here's Richard's interview with Kenny Crouch.
Hello, this is Richard Green, and today I have the pleasure to be talking to a friend of mine, Kenny Crouch. Kenny and I go back a long way. Hi, Kenny, how are you?
All fine, Richard. Yeah, all good. Thank you.
Listen, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us about this today. As I said, the idea is it's a chat around the costume business and maybe giving some people who don't know how the business works some insights and how to get into it and how various people have got where they are. You're a wardrobe supervisor, top of your tree, top of your game. But how did you start?
Well, if my memory serves me right, you know, a long time ago, about 51 years ago, I left school at 15, no qualifications, had a few odd jobs beforehand.
Right.
But then worked for the evening news in Fleet Street as a messenger boy.
Yeah.
Would pick up the newspapers. They would come out 3 or 4 editions a day then. And on the back page, a small advert that said, "Find me a tiger skin to a tiara and just a telephone number." Quite intrigued by that, I called the number. It was actually Berman's in Irving Street. The costume,
right.
You know, went along for an interview. The job I was actually interviewed for was in the production department with Noel Howard. They had gone, but Noel quite kindly said that they might need a boy down in the basement in the men's department. Went down and saw Sid Bowles, I think, who gave me this job as a 15-year-old, just shortly before my 16th birthday, yeah. I think that was on a Friday. Started work on the Monday. I mean, the first job they gave me was send me round to Berman's. In those days, they had various places all over the West End, the military.
That's right. What year was this, Ken?
69.
Right, okay, yeah. So they had Orange Street, didn't they? And they had a place in Cranbourne Street.
Cranbourne Street is where the military department was, and got around there on the first day.
Yeah.
The first job was 200 pairs of army boots.
Down in the basement, in the basement in Cranbourne Street.
Exactly. I think they'd just come back off Kenny's Heroes or Patton or something, yeah.
There was a Renault car showroom there, wasn't there? And it's now Pret-a-Manger, I think.
But, I mean, rather than do one after the other methodically, I went home that night and worked out such a complicated spreadsheet that I would go in the next day and scrape mud off every fifth upper, apply polish to every second toe cap, you know, just so I had some kind of system that I had to revert back to all the time. And,
yeah.
You know, finally got through it. I knew it was a test. I knew it was a test, but did it.
Yeah.
2 weeks, I think it took. Yeah. But yeah, I had that.
They made you polish them as well, did they?
Yeah, no, I had to clean them and polish them. Yeah. Not bullying them, fortunately enough, but. You know,
No.
Yeah.
Well, if you had to bull 200 pairs, you'd still be there with a hot spoon and a tub of cherry blossom, wouldn't you?
That took up the first 2 weeks. I think the third week, back in Irving Street, where I was based, Max Berman, Monty's father, called me into the office, gave me a copy of Spotlight, the actor's directory with the photographs in. I'm sure you're familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
yep.
Going through, he'd put crosses on various photographs with names, and I said, "What are these, boy?" He said, "Well, see these names. Go through all the costumes downstairs. If you see any of these names that I'll put a cross on, take the labels out. No one wants to wear dead men's clothes."
Oh my God.
It crossed out all the people that had died, yeah, and made me take out the labels. But I probably took out labels of some great, great 60s actors and earlier. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because now, of course, with Stephen and the prop store, you know, anything that's actually got the name of an actor in it has got a value. And, you're probably taking out, I don't know, John Gielgud's suit label from something, or one of Laurence Olivier's outfits. Yeah, amazing.
That was all for the princely sum then of, you know, I know it was 1969, of £9 a week.
Yeah, but even by today's standards, even if you multiply it up to modern day standards, that's not a lot of money, is it?
No, I think that a pint was only half a crown, like 12p or something. But I was supplementing that by going over to the theatres. Obviously, we're in the West End, and I would do dressing in the theatres, which I loved. Finish work at half hour, straight over to the ambassador or what have you, and get £2 a night dressing.
To sort of supplement your income then, yeah?
Yeah, I almost doubled it, which was great, yeah.
Yeah.
And get the last bus home, you know, so it was great.
Mm, yeah.
But that was the start. I was there for many years. Berman's, a few years later, bought out Nathan's, another big costume house. Yeah,
71, I think, 72.
Maybe. 71, yeah. 72, I think, yeah, maybe, yeah. And then we moved to Camden. That was move to big costume houses, all those places around the West End into the lovely building that we had at Camden.
And I mean, I knew you at that point. I mean, I joined Berman's for a while in 73, but by 76, when I came back, you were there. But, and I was trying to think the other day, when did you actually leave?
I left, I think, in about 78, I think.
Right, yeah.
Berman's in those days would allow their staff, their costumers, to almost like loaned out. So I had quite a lot of experience on set. We would go and do fittings for films like Young Winston, Bridge Too Far, I think, Great Gatsby, the Robert Redford Great Gatsby, Murder on the Orient Express. I would also take 3 or 4 weeks holiday and do the same. And I went over to Vienna to do Prisoner's End, Peter Sellers.
Did you? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then really got the bug, came back. I think that was 78. And left to go freelance. So,
you know, you were obviously highly thought of as a men's, because again, it was just men's and ladies' costumers, different jobs. You didn't do women's costumes any more than I did civilian costumes in the military department. But you obviously had a good reputation by the time you left as being a good theatrical costumier, a men's costumier. Were you worried when you went out? I mean, presumably you were going out to do a specific job, but the security of being in a costume house and then the uncertainty of being freelance, did that worry you?
It did a bit, but, you know, I was still quite young then, Richard, you know. I was single. So, yeah, I mean, took a gamble. And the work wasn't that busy as it is now. And I had to work abroad in the first few years because the industry was very unionized, you know, almost a job. You know, you couldn't work in the UK studios initially. So I did a couple of films abroad. Prisoner's End, I must have spent 6 months in Prague, I think we shot that. But came back and eventually got into the union.
Right. Because at that point, you had to pass tests, didn't you? They were very, fairly rigorous tests, weren't they?
Yeah, and you had to do it all. You had to do sewing, you had to do breaking.
Mm.
You know, now we have departments to cope with all that. Costumers now, all that done for them. But no, we did the whole lot. Well, once that test, then you had to go to be in front of a very daunting panel to be interviewed, and I say I got in. You didn't have to spend 3 years just being assistant. You couldn't go and supervise.
Is that, I've forgotten that, you know, that's right. I mean, it really was, wasn't it, for better or for worse, and this would have been NatKey, presumably, wouldn't it?
NatKey then, yeah, sure, before.
Yeah, you know, you actually had to go through all of those stages, didn't you? And there was no shortcuts on those things. I mean, you know, if you hadn't done your 3 years and somebody wanted you as a supervisor, you wouldn't have been able to
do it. Oh, no, absolutely not. And if they, you know, if you were found out to do stuff, you know, you'd have been.
I just mentally got a picture of the people that you would have stood in front of that interview. And formidable, I think, is probably the best phrase.
Frank Vinyl and Donald Mothersill. I mean, names that probably don't mean.
Yeah, Tiny, presumably.
Yeah. Dave Murphy was there. I mean, he was my saviour, really. He realised that at that time I was just sort of, they really should have been encouraging to come into the industry.
Well, and again, Dave would have been younger than most of the others that you mentioned there, I would have thought. So again, he would have had a slightly more progressive approach to the whole thing. So what was your first costume supervising job then, Kenny?
Supervising? I shouldn't have supervised. What would happen? I did films with Pennywise earlier, so things like The Wall and Another Country.
Yeah.
But we had to employ a costume supervisor as it almost goes to my job, really. So I was actually in charge. The supervisor would just stay in the wardrobe department.
So you had a sort of camouflage supervisor that would... Penny, you know, really kind of valued your work and encouraged you to do that as well. So what do you think makes a good supervisor? I mean, you know, organizational skills, but just if I was thinking of doing this job, what would you tell me is the most important thing to do?
Well, I mean, supervising now has changed drastically.
Yeah.
It's almost office bound, working the budget, just logistics. And, you know, I always say now, if I touch a costume, it's very rare. It's changed enormously. Yeah. The only reason why I actually wanted to go and supervise, I was quite happy being a wardrobe assistant, working on the floor, working with the actors. Is that at those times it was done so badly, and I thought, this has to be done better.
Yeah.
And the only way I could change it really was to supervise.
Do it yourself, in fact. I'm intrigued to learn that, you know, your first kind of task at Berman's, 200 pairs of army boots, you actually sort of, you know, went back and devised a system to do that. Because again, one of your greatest strengths, I'd say, and you have many, but one of your greatest strengths is actually that whole ability to plan and organize and control and keep all of these plates spinning at the same time. Your organizational skills are phenomenal.
Even more so in these days. I mean, you know, location work now is getting less and less with green screen and CG. But, you know, to get a couple of thousand people in full armour in a desert somewhere, you know, took some, as you say, some organisational skills.
Yeah.
I mean, just going back to the, just as a little aside, going back to the cleaning boot incident, my first freelance job, it was all quite on the Western Front.
Yeah.
The remake of the classic 30s one, which we shot in Prague.
Yeah.
And the director came up to me and there was a parade and said that he wanted 200 pairs of army boots, these kids having boots like shiny. I'm at the trenches. We never shoot stuff in order.
Right.
I thought, how the hell am I going to do this? This is probably on the Friday. Again, we're shooting on the Monday. I called the kids together and through the interpreter said, we're going to have a competition. For $25, you're going to take the boots home. You're going to find someone who knows how to ball boot. You're going to come back on Monday morning with your boots gleaming. And Richard, it worked a treat. It was $25 US I think I've ever spent. You know, it was $25 then was quite a lot of money. You know, it's probably some people pick it out.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot. You know, it's better 200 people doing one thing than one person doing 200.
Yes. Yeah. One person doing 200 things. Yeah. I'm intrigued. And I know it's a fact that, you know, you talk about the fact that teams and the whole business has changed and it has, hasn't it? I mean, I think, you know, if I think of the number of people that would be on a pretty major film back in the day, what, 5, 6, bring in some dailies for some of the heavier days?
I mean, Out of Africa, which was a great film, won the best film, got nominated for costume.
Milena
Cannonero.
Yeah, yeah.
We shot most of that in Kenya. There was some back in Shepherd and Shooter. Majority, we took, including myself, 4 people to Kenya. We had big actors, Meryl Streep, Robert Redford, 4 people in that department. We picked up some local crew, obviously, but there was 4 trained UK staff. Quite recently on Captain America, I think we had over 200 people working, from 4 to 200. I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah. Why?
Why exactly, yeah. I think early days, the costumes would all be made in a costume house. Now the fashion is to set up in-house workrooms. I'm not sure whether that's, you know, a good thing. It gives the costume designers complete control, I suppose. But they have to be filled in a big breaking down department. I find it extraordinary that, you know, and it's not only just only our department, all departments now seem to have swelled. Stanley Kubrick was notorious for having 3 or 4 people. He would operate the camera himself. He would have the actors in there. Maybe the continuity girl and the sound recorders, and that would be it.
Yeah. I was trying to think about what, you know, why there is this difference. And I suppose possibly, again, you've already touched on it. You know, Nat Key Union was fairly protective and fairly kind of closed shoppy about who could work and who couldn't work, which maybe, you know, once the brakes come off there, then anybody can actually become involved in costume. And also, I suppose it's the time, you know, when I think about all those shows that you've mentioned back in the 70s and the 80s, there was lots of prep time. There was time to get those things done. There were actors that you could fit an actor once or twice, maybe even 3 times before they were going to the costumes were going to go out the building.
That's so, yeah, that's so true.
Maybe that's another factor, you know, that because there's less time, you need more people to do, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, you need more people to do things quickly.
No, it's true, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the early days, the costume designer, it was almost done like a theatre. You know, you would have all the actors before we start shooting. They would have a dress parade. They would line up in front of the director. And then the costume designer would not complete the film. May come in, you know, if a new costume were to be established. But generally, it was all done beforehand and passed over to the wardrobe department.
Yeah, sort of handed over to you to actually run.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I've done my creative bit. Now you go and make it work.
Exactly that. Now, late casting, you know, scripts changes, the costume design is on quite widely all the way through. And, you know, we have to have the whole show with us these days. You know, the schedule doesn't mean much, do you? It changes so much. So just in case, I always say just in case, the three most expensive words in the industry. Every, you know, for every department, just in case, and it stays in the case, you know. But, you know, special effects, having snow, rain, wind, every single day we carry 3 or 4 trucks full of costumes just in case things change. It's a crazy way of operating, really.
Yeah, and again, I suppose you're going to have to, you know, quite often now you said green screen, you have to cater for that. You possibly have to cater for some locations or a second unit that are out doing something somewhere else.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, yeah. Now, you have a pretty regular team that you work with.
I do, yeah. I mean, you do get out of sync. You try and keep the team together, but, you know, you do get out of sync.
And obviously that's a very important thing. You know, you need the backup that that they provide you.
Oh yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to give people a flavour of it, as I said to you, you know, you're top of the game here. You pretty much can choose which productions you want to do. You've worked on some massive great ones. I'm not going to go all the way through them because, frankly, we haven't got time. But describe a sort of average day once you're up and running, never mind when before the camera starts to shoot, but an average day for you, Kenny, how does that work?
Well, first you have to get up, which invariably is at 4 o'clock in the morning on a shoot day.
Right.
You know, wherever you live, you know, the location seems to be the farthest away. Wherever.
Most
of the films now are studio based. Pinewood is probably the nearest. Leavesden is another close one. So a drive to the studio could take an hour or so on a big crowd day, for instance. Again, going back to how things were and how they are now, old times you would get the crowd, big crowd, on the set for 12 o'clock. Maybe it would take all morning to light. Now they need, or they don't need, they ask for every single crowd person, every single horse to be saddled 8 o'clock. The camera's not even out the truck. So you have to cater for that. So that means some early starts. No one crowd, you know, dressed quicker than me. I mean, I'm known for that. You know, if it takes a half hour to get one person dressed, it should take half an hour to get 1,000 people dressed, as long as they're doing it all together.
That's your 200 people cleaning one pair of boots type syndrome.
Exactly that, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would always go onto the set first, make sure things are okay, help dress, and then go back to the office and sign God knows how much paperwork. Monday mornings are a classic because there's, again, 200 time sheets to go through and check. Everyone doing different times, you know, and you rely on their honesty to put the right times, but you have to go through and check. Sometimes there are mistakes. I'm waiting for someone to devise some kind of software that it can be done automatic, because the overtime rates have just come in, really. We was always on a flat rate up until a few years ago. Now, quite rightly, people are getting paid for their time, but their hours are always different, you know. So, and it's a very complicated system. I don't have to work that out, the actual payment, but you have to work out the hours.
Yeah, and you have to put that raw information in so somebody can figure out all
those. Yeah, exactly that, yeah. And there's endless, you know, endless paperwork, PO, petty cash vouchers, health and safety reports. So it is very much a supervisor is very much an office-based occupier.
Yeah. And again, let's not kid ourselves. You know, at the level that you operate at, we're talking about many hundreds of thousands of pounds worth
budget. Yeah, millions. You know, yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, I have no training as an accountant, and I do my best, and I do it quite well. But as I say, if I if I can touch a costume, it's joy. Yeah. You know, if I can go on.
Well, as I say, I reckon if you touch a costume, it's because it's fallen off a hanger and you've decided you're going to pick it up. but as you're walking through.
If I get called onto the set, it's either there's a problem or I go on the set, it's because I've got nothing to do. I'm just going on, you know.
Right.
I very rarely go onto the set, you know, and often I have to go ahead as well, ahead of the shooting unit, looking for location bases, which some supervisors don't do, but I like to know where we're going to change and put my expertise into how things work.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, Kenny, you know, you're the guy that knows what you need and what will work. Rocking up to a place with 18 flights of stairs, no lift and you know, no natural light isn't going to make it an ideal wardrobe location for you, is it?
Exactly that, yeah. And I often say, you know, I can get crowd ready and any room they give me, but it just takes time.
So I'm interested in this. So the in-costume calls now are much earlier than they used to be, are they? Even though they're not, are they still going to turn over about midday or...?
Well, and that's what usually happens, Richard. You know, you get everybody ready to in elaborate costumes and they sit around all day eating the catering out of house and home.
Yes.
That's what invariably happens.
Why is that then? I mean, you know, is it just because people want the security of knowing that the things are all ready to go? Or I'm just slightly confused.
It's exactly that. So things have changed. Directors now have most of the power. Actors have say as well, but producers really don't have the power, you know, so they can come in and change the shot, change the scene, change the sequence at a whim, really. You know, in the days before emails, they couldn't do that, of course. They couldn't contact us and say, we're changing the scene tomorrow morning at, you know, from scene 28 to 57 or whatever.
Yeah.
They can notify so quickly now that they can do that. Dickie Attenborough, I've done quite a lot of films with, would send like memos to HOD to be wanted to change the sequence. You'll get it a day before. You know, they stuck to the schedule. They stuck to the script. Very, very rarely happens now.
And there is probably a whole separate discussion to be made about the fact that electronically now, you know, somebody sends an email saying, I've changed it and I want everybody dressed now in working class outfits instead of the middle class outfits that you've prepped. Doesn't mean that that's happened. Just because you've sent an email asking for that, and I think sometimes there is this mistake that I've sent an email, therefore it's going to happen instantly.
Right, exactly that, yeah.
Yeah, and of course it doesn't, does it?
No.
Yeah.
So invariably, going back to what we were saying earlier, each department carries the whole show around with them.
You know,
The camera department's got every lens, the grip truck's got every piece of camera equipment, dollies, and not just brought in for the specific shot, but...
So for argument's sake, they'll have to have the track in case somebody wants a tracking shot all of a sudden.
And the Steadicam's on the truck in case suddenly they want to change to a Steadicam. You know, the Steadicam will just be brought in maybe on a day or two, you know, and a whole schedule just to do the...
Yeah. I mean, again, those things must add incredibly to the cost. I mean, you know, if you're renting your Steadicam, however much it is a day, if you know you're going to need it for 2 weeks, you rent it in for 2 weeks. But if you've got a 12-week shoot and you think, just in case, fortune.
And the same goes for costumes. You know, if you stuck to the schedule, we could come to you, hire costumes just for a few weeks. Once that season's done, return them. You keep that whole show now for the whole of the production. And then beyond, because of the bad planning, practically every single film, every single major film, you have reshoots. I mean, I don't think I've done a film in a long
time. Reshoots, I know. Tell me, reshoots on reshoots sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think they call them enhancements, don't they? I mean,
well, yeah, they may call them that, Kenny. I've got another word for them. But, And the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was this, you know, first of all, there was legal, then there was health and safety, and now there's clearance. That can't make life easy either.
Exactly. Going back to the amount of paperwork, clearance is even a pattern on a jumper may have to be cleared. It certainly has to be sent off to the clearance, you know, company.
Yeah.
You know, just like that.
And presumably anything that's got a Nike tick or added a stripe or a whatever is completely out.
And I've just been involved with something that even fonts, you know, even like fonts on a T-shirt that we may print up, but the font, someone owns that or they think to someone. So you can't even use just a regular font or a font that you might just pick up on.
No, that's, again, that's something I didn't even stop to think about. I mean, I know that people have invented fonts and therefore I suppose they belong to the person who's kind of registered them, but I didn't think that you'd need to stop and think about that.
And, you know, the military side of it now, the amount of, you know, detail we used to go into on those earlier war films.
Yeah.
Down to the last button, but now they make films, very successful films, but there's not a ranking, there's not a button,
no
military badge, there's not a medal ribbon, just to get over this legal thing. They just do with it.
Well, I mean, the whole of my career basically has been built on getting military and police and civil uniform insignia and logos right.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember that production you and I did a little while ago. We're not going to name it, but we did all of those high-ranking officers, button perfect, medal perfect, insignia perfect. You remember? And we had to change it.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you know, I sometimes think, well, why are we bothering? Because we might as well just put plastic buttons on it or something and just...
Yeah. Listen, it's still a very exciting industry, you know.
Yes.
You know, I go onto the set, you see like 200 or 300 people dressed on horseback, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck still go up. It's still great, yeah. And I don't want to encourage anyone going into it. What I would say, it's not that well paid anymore on a comparative thing. I taught my two daughters not to enter the industry. They now work in the city. They're both in their early 30s, both earn more than me, and I'm top of my game.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not bad paid, but it's not well paid. And for just an ordinary costumier that may have 3 or 4 months out, they'll never earn their fortune.
I have heard it said, you know, that costume supervisor, the money that you get additionally to being in the costume department really isn't worth the amount of grief and effort.
No. And I say the only reason why I went into that was I was happy. It's just that I knew it had to be done better.
Yes.
And the only way that I can make better or change it was to be in charge.
I mean, of course, you're absolutely right. It is an incredible business still and chock full of extremely talented people and dedicated people. And it wouldn't actually happen if it wasn't for that. You know, I touched on it a bit earlier. Your team is incredibly important to you. And I suppose... What do you fundamentally do you see your responsibility with the costume designer or with the production?
You're almost a go-between, you know.
Yeah.
I work with the costume designer, but you have to keep production sweet. It's no point in alienating them. Some people do, some designers do, but
yeah,
it's a toughie really to keep that equal balance.
Yeah.
Costume designers are under a much more enormous strain now. I said earlier, it was all done usually before they started shooting. Now they get their actors a day or two before things change. It's tough on them now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we both know situations, haven't we, where they parachute a guest actor in, perhaps from America or something, on the Friday, you know, and they're in front of camera on Monday morning.
Exactly that, yeah.
Yeah.
And the other big change, I mean, you know, we used to work for the director. His film, if he was happy with a costume. Now there's 20 people that have a say. You know, I'm on conference calls with execs and marketing people, and it's just extraordinary that everyone has a say now on the look. Don't make the costumes too complicated because it will make the dolls more expensive to make.
Well, yeah, I was gonna get to that actually. I was just gonna say, you know, basically, are we doing full scale samples for the? For the 12-inch doll merchandise.
They're usually the first people you see as well, because they have to get their stuff into production, hit the release date, so they're usually the first to come for the door. You know, you've not even got drawn yet, but they want to know, you know, what their dolls are going to look like. So, yeah. You know, we all know marketing brings in more money than the box office, really, on these major
movies. Yes. Yeah,
quite understand.
And the relationship over the years you've had with costume houses, I mean, you know, as I say, you and I have had a great relationship, but costume houses still are, you mentioned designers having their own workrooms, and they've got 24/7 access, and they sometimes need that, of course, for last-minute changes and stuff. But the role that costume houses play is still an important one, isn't it?
Oh, paramount, really, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And no better place for anyone to start their career, I always said. I know that you've got a training program going on.
Yeah.
You can read as many books as you want about costume. There's nothing like, you know, picking up a 1940s suit or what have you and just getting the feel. And the only way you're going to do that is at a costume house. Coupled with that is where you meet people. You know, designers come in all the time, supervisors. I could sit in your reception and pick up job after job, I think, and I have done, I think, just by people walking
through the door. Yeah. So who was the person, I'm just curious now, it's a long time ago, so nobody's going to be in trouble. Who was the person that poached you from the men's department then? Can you remember? You must remember.
Jimmy Smith.
Was it Jimmy?
He'd poached me before. I'd gone on, as I say, took holidays. He did Prisoner of Zender at Vienna. Me and Ron Morby, another friend of ours, went out there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
All Quiet on the Western Front was the first film. As a footnote, after 3 weeks, he left. he was notorious for that and left me, his ex-girlfriend, and his driver running a big film at the time. So, again, that was being thrown in the deep end.
Yeah.
I'm very fond of Jimmy. He went on to look after Michael Caine. And
I was going to say, Michael Caine wouldn't make a film without him, would he?
No, absolutely not. No.
But I've known some wardrobe supervisors roll their eyes in despair because, you know, they've been, as well as their team, Jimmy's along.
you have to inherit him, yeah.
He was a great guy. It is a great industry, and you, again, you know, learnt your craft, and this is a theme that's constantly coming back in these things, you know, that people have to put in that time to get it, to get the experience.
Yeah, no, exactly that, yeah. Richard, I don't second guess anything, you know, all my knowledge comes from experience. I've done it before. I know what works, I know what doesn't work. And sometimes, you know, because I've been around for a long time, that can go against me because I know, and I've had many a battle with a producer about, you know, size of changing areas, size of marquees that we need to put up. I know what's needed. They come into the crowd marquees at 9 o'clock when it's empty, everyone's on set, and say, you know, this tent's too big, it's empty. Which I quite agree, but 3 hours ago it was too small.
Yeah, 3 hours ago you couldn't move. Yeah, yeah.
And 7 o'clock in the evening, it's going to be too small.
Can I ask you, it doesn't have to be a production, but what's the thing, professional thing, I mean, the thing you're most proud of, I'm sure, are your daughters and your family, but the professional thing that you're proudest of in your career?
Oh, tough question.
I know. Well, I don't ask easy ones.
I think that I've lasted... I've lasted 51 years.
Yes. and still haven't been found out.
And still getting away with it, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
No, and to introduce, I think, you know, people might have had other ideas, but it introduced a whole number changing system to get crowds ready very quickly.
Yeah.
I think I started that in big marquees. It was all done when I was at Pinewood. Two at a time, please. Next two. You know, and they'd be queuing around the block.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To a streamline that, the old checky bags. I actually brought the checky bags into the UK.
Did you?
I was working on, the first person to use checky bags. Yeah, I was working on Empire of the Sun in China. I saw them introduce a system where people, brought a couple of 100 back, a couple of 1,000 back, I think. We were shooting in Spain and back in the UK. And a few years later, they were flooding in. And I think that's the mainstay. I work with Penny, as you know, quite. On my 50th birthday party, the department organised and baked me a big cake, which was a checky bag.
I love it.
On my 60th birthday, it was a white, one of those big white marquees as a cake.
You know, nice. Have you got pictures of those, Kenny?
I'll probably have somewhere, yeah.
No, yeah, well, I might stick those up on our website because that's quite that's a lovely thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to your wardrobe departments on a number of occasions, and they are like a military operation. You know, I mean, everything's in place. It is, and I mean this in a complimentary way. It's like a quartermaster's stores. If you want to know where the size 10 black Oxford shoes are, there they are. There's no scrabbling around looking for them. If you want to know where all the, you know, the 42 chest check suits are, they're over there. It's a phenomenal.
And I think, I mean, the days of working like 10 or 11 years in the costume houses, you know, working with great people like Eric Hawkes, you know, we all know Dougie, Eric's father, was a great mentor to me, Sid Bowles, Bob Worth, great characters, great at their job, obviously no longer with them.
Yeah, and you're right, you know, they taught us how to lay out a fitting room, how to put together a costume, how to dress a costume on a hanger, all those things, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. How to pack a locker. You know, those days, costumes were packed away in lockers, metre or so square. that the costumier would come along in a rush fitting, pull the whole lot out, leave it on the floor, and then I'd always come behind and repack it. You know, I need to be pulled out, you know, a few hours later by another.
Yeah, or by your head of department because it wasn't good enough. I mean, it was a bit like laying bricks. It was like building a brick wall, wasn't it? You know, if you didn't stack it properly.
Build into the corners,
Headers and stretchers, that's what it was. Headers and stretchers. Here I am. I want you to close your eyes and imagine this because it's a bit of a stretch of imagination, but I'm a 15-year-old who wants to get, well, I'm a 16-year-old now because I can't leave school quite early enough. 16-year-old who wants to get into the business. I want to be the next Kenny. What's your advice?
Get a job in a costume house for a good couple of years.
Okay, yeah.
There's no better training. There's no better training. I don't know how your training system goes down. If you've got some kind of internship, haven't you?
Yeah, we had an apprenticeship course running at one point, and you know, they basically did everything. I think you're absolutely right.
Invaluable, really. I mean, I suppose people should still go to university if they're allowed to, but you know, I get lots of CVs with all their qualifications, and it astounds me, really. But there's nothing like firsthand, really.
What do you look for then? I mean, again, I've spoken to some people about the whole kind of nurturing thing, and they do see their role as a senior person in the business as being responsible for bringing on the next generation. And I'm sure you do exactly the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm all for, you know, we give people work experience, but, you know, 2 weeks, what can you, you know, when invariably people are busy, so I can't really give them, I don't give them the boots to clean.
No. Well, I don't know. I mean, it didn't do you any harm.
Oh, no, quite, no.
Especially if they then show the mouse and get 200 people and offer them a $25 reward for the cleanest pair.
You know, these films now do hoover up quite a lot of costume people.
Yeah.
I've never known the industry until this happened to be so busy, you know, with so much going on. With the addition of streaming now, streaming these channels, these productions, I like doing 4 films, so 8 1-hour episodes, 10 1-hour episodes. I've done a for a massive, it's the biggest budget I've ever done, and it's for a streaming chapter, a new production. I can't go into detail.
And you don't mind, do you? I mean, again, most of your career has been on big feature films because that's
what I do.
That's where the experience and the expertise was needed. But you don't mind whether it's film, TV, or a streaming channel, do you?
Not at all. No. There's no, as far as our job's concerned now, there's no difference.
No. And would you turn a show down if you got a script and you must get umpteen scripts dropping through the door saying, hey, I want you to work on this one, would you make a decision about whether you wanted to work on it or not if the script didn't interest you?
Yes, I would, yeah. More, I ask questions more, you know, where's it being shot? I've done, you know, so much travelling. I now like to stay at home. I'm almost retired now. There's a lot of other factors that I would consider. And, you know, the difficult situation comes when, at times, when I get offered 2 or 3, which one do you choose? I turned down Braveheart to come and do, I think what I came back to do, but something that I turned down Save It Private Ryan to come back to do the Avengers, not the Avengers Marvel film, but...
Yeah, the Avengers Steed and Mrs. Peel film.
I did that through choice, not because of the content, because I had a young family then. It meant coming home and not being away for months and months at a time.
Yeah.
Without the support of my wife, who did a tremendous job bringing up my kids. That doesn't happen so much now. Most people, you know, cheapest way of making movies is, you know, people sleeping in their own beds, eating their own food and driving their own cars. You know, so they're much more studio-based now. There's no need, really, to go abroad, which, again, is a thing, because that would, you know, certainly when I was single, that was a big attraction.
Well, yeah, that was the whole point, wasn't it? That was actually getting away and almost the days before lots of very, very cheap airline travel. It was a great way to see various parts of the world at somebody else's expense.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And when I got married and had the kids, that became the biggest hindrance, of course. But, you know, it was a... Yeah. I've been to places that you never dream. Not only are you going to these on location, but, you know, I've been inside the Kremlin, locations that you can never even get near, you know.
Yeah.
It's been a fabulous, fabulous career, yeah. And it'll all be down as in a book one day, hopefully. I've started. My wife started writing there.
Oh, have you? Oh, that's good.
Well,
that's good.
It's not memoirs. It's just anecdotes. It's just so you can pick up a page and there'll be a story. And, you know, I've got stories to tell, but... everybody in the industry's got a story to tell. Someone should be compiling it early before we all, you know,
steady. we've still got 40 years, Kenny, don't you?
these stories got lost. You know, the big thing now as well is that it's the confidentiality clauses that we all have to sign now.
You've anticipated me, because again, that was going to be another one of my questions. We're doing a production. Okay, what's it called? I can't tell you. Okay, what's it about? I can't tell you. It's like, sign this piece of paper and tell me that you'll never tell this to a living soul. Well, I need to discuss it with the people here at some point. Yeah, I mean, it must drive you nuts.
Oh yeah, quite, yeah. I'm not sure if anyone's ever been sued for giving away a story or two. I think they've probably lost their job. But I say, when I retire, when I care. Doing those superhero movies, I always say, just let the paparazzi have the photograph. But at least it'll be the actor in the correct costume, whether that's a Batman costume. Because invariably, they get an overweight stuntman in it who's got trainers on, you know, or the actress that has not had her makeup done. Let them have it. Just let them have it, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And some directors do. Chris Nolan allows the paparazzi, you know, and he releases it. It'll be a bit out of focus, but it'll allow the still to go out.
Yeah, control it rather than leave it uncontrolled.
Exactly that, yeah.
We've all done and said and done things that we regret, but is there anything professionally that you regret you haven't done or you've done?
I don't know. I've always not regretted, but not leaving school at 15 with no education, really. Mm. And I've said one of my aims in retirement, if I ever get around to it, is do an open university degree. I want to prove to my very well-educated daughters that, you know.
my dad ain't dumb either.
If I had the chance that I gave them, that I might have made something out of my life.
Well, I've got to say, I think you've made more than just a little something
in your life. Yeah.
And if your daughters haven't sussed out by now the fact that their old man's a wise old thing, then they're not as wise as they think they are.
Yeah. You know, by probably educating my children, I entered the realms of upper middle class amongst professional people, lots of my friends. That's one thing I have done. I've kept my professional life and social life completely apart. Really.
Yeah.
I thought that's very important, really. You know, you're seeing people that work 18 hours a day. Even on location, I like to keep myself to myself. I now go to dinner parties with bankers that are getting million-pound bonuses. I'm certainly the lowest paid, although I'm not always one person, you know. Yeah. Surveyors. Do I regret? No, not at all. You know,
good.
I've got better dinner story.
Yeah, I was going to say, you bet your stories are more interesting than their stories.
Then, exactly. It's been a great 51 years. God, our time is gone.
Yeah.
No regrets at all. No regrets.
No. And, of course, there is that anecdotal story, and I don't know whether it is one of those urban myth stories, but the time that when you first joined Burmans, you had very long hair, I believe.
I did indeed, yeah.
And at that point, all the costumiers had to wear warehouse coats, didn't they? I think it was white for managers and brown. For the staff, yeah. And didn't Max Burman, Monty's father, once go, "Who's that girl going downstairs as you disappeared down the stairs of Irving Street with your long locks flying?"
I mean, those early days at Burman's, because being in the West End during the late 60s was a great place to be. But, you know, and then going off to the theatre, I absolutely loved it. But it was a sad day for us all, I think, when we moved. I know it wasn't that far, but it seemed a million miles away when we moved all over the Camden Town.
Well, the other good thing, of course, about that was that you could actually conveniently get yourself lost. You know, I mean, from Cranbourne Street to the Drury Lane, the old Nathan's building, going up Long Acre.
Yeah.
You know, you could make that journey last about half an hour if you were clever. And George Bennett would go, "Where have you been?" "Oh, well, I just said to."
I mean, Burma's had, and Nathan's too, they had Shorts Gardens. There were so many. West Street.
Yeah, well, I was just trying to think. Orange Street, Rupert Street, Shorts Gardens, obviously Cranbourne Street, obviously Irving Street. And I think there may have been a couple more kicking around somewhere. The
big one in South Kent.
Yeah. You know, do you remember that there was the Kingsway building that was underground
yeah.
over there? That was where all the longest day uniform equipment, American equipment, was stored and all that.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
Harry Perman. Anyway, well, listen, it was a pleasure to meet you 50. Well, actually, it wasn't 51 years ago. Hang on, 73. So what's that? 73? That's 27. 47 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's still a pleasure to meet you whenever you come in now. So I think, you know, it's been great, Kenny. I admire what you've done, the way you run your film units, and the way, you know, as I say, you're top of the game. I do appreciate you spending some time with us.
No, it's been great. And I just hope we all get back together soon.
That was Richard's conversation with Kenny. It's great always to listen to Kenny. He's got so many stories as well. When he comes to the office, it's nothing better than sitting down and just shooting the breeze with Kenny for about 10, 15 minutes, because he's fantastic. Yeah. And I hope people can hear that from the interview.
And I hope he gets that book that he's talking about written as well. There are various things that we couldn't mention in that interview because they were sort of either slanderous or unkind, but the book would be quite interesting.
When he's talking about the Czech bags, he's talking about those plastic blue and white bags that everyone's carrying.
Yes, he's talking about those grey sort of plastic fibre check bags with the zips that break off after two uses, and they are ubiquitous now. They are everywhere, in case anybody doesn't know what ubiquitous is.
I always remember Ruth Meyers designing the costumes for a film called Children of Ember, and she had a team of makers unthreading those checky placky bags in order to make costume out of them.
Really?
Her concept at that time for that story was that was the only material that was left in the world.
Oh, a sort of dystopian world, and that was the only thing that had survived.
Yeah, it was so unable to be biodegradable that the only fabric that remained was that, which people then picked off and recreated into their own clothing.
That's another thread that we should really investigate at some point. And biodegradable is exactly what's maybe.
Well, we've got that coming up with Sinead Cadell when.
Oh, right. Okay.
About,
good.
Sustainability and
yeah.
Albert.
Yeah.
The other thing Kenny mentions, which again I think a little bit of explanation is useful with, is the crowd days that they talk about and the fittings that they do for those. They are such a military operation when you've got a big crowd day coming up. They're huge operations that you've got, whether it's tents or rooms, and you literally can have 100, 200 people turning up. You've got to try all different options on, choose the right one, photograph it and move on to the next, and then keep the notes well enough or photos well enough so that you can pass them on to the people who are actually going to fit them on the day.
Yeah.
Success of Kenny's
system,
organization system is again, it's down to the fact that he is able to have his eye on the bigger picture, and the relationships that he develops with ADs, and in terms of how they are drawn in to his operation and respect the process in order then to bring the schedule in within that day's shoot, incorporating costume. What happens if you don't have that amount of precision is that you're constantly being screened at by ADs because you're not meeting the demands of the shoot. Whereas someone like Kenny will make sure that negotiation happens way ahead so that there's no mistaking what needs to be done from a costume point of view, in terms of setup, dressing, preparation, and then off to wherever it is that they need to be shot on. And so many supervisors that haven't had that experience in training make the mistake that they don't communicate what they need at the right time in order for them to proceed and be part of the overall. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and again, Kenny touches on that, doesn't he? You know, it's quite easy to be sort of bullied, because all of this has economic implications.
Yeah.
You know, if you say, I need 30 people to run this particular crowd dressing day, you need 30 people. If production turn around and say, well, you can only have 15, then there's implications. But somebody with Kenny's experience can say, this is what I want and this is how it has to be, and they'll listen to him, whereas it's easy to get sort of steamrolled in saying, oh, okay, then fine, we'll do it in the ladies' changing rooms over at the bath.
There's lots of ways to communicate that and to make that negotiation. And we've heard with Andrew Hunt, we will hear with David Davenport, you know, everyone has their own way of approaching productions in order to achieve the overall. And yeah. It's fascinating how this is evolving, because we're seeing, as we set out at the start, it's about realizing different people's process and practice and how they achieve what they manage within their careers. Yeah.
The next interview we are going to be releasing is mine with Verity Hawkes. Verity Hawkes is a costume designer. She's worked in TV, film, commercials. She's got a fantastic insight into everything. And aside from all that, she's actually just a lovely person to work with as well.
She is. She's great.
We hope you've been enjoying these conversations. And here's a small excerpt of my interview with Verity Hawkes.
Because on a commercial, you don't have time to spend travelling around and sourcing things. You don't have time to go vintage shopping. You don't have the budget or the time, but you don't have the ability to say, I'd love to make that. Whereas on a film, you'd go, you'd do your reference and you'd maybe design something very specific and have it made, or you'd see if you could source the shoes, say, or the jewellery vintage for a period. But on a commercial, you just have to do it in such a small time frame that you have to be much more resourceful, I think, and you have to work with what you have available at that present time. So if you can't get hold of something, you have to either change your design or find a different way of doing it, find another way around getting to the point that you're happy with the end design.